race until the Jockey Club Gold Cup. And, right. and that was when Albert the Great wired the field. And Albert the Great was a very, very good horse. Very, I think, underappreciated horse. I think the three-year-olds that year in 2000 were better from top to bottom, Fusaichi Pegasus aside. And so that was, you know, no surprise by the year, the end of the year, that they had caught up to the elders, if not surpassed them a bit.
Was there a stranger Breeders' Cup Classic than that 99 that Cat Thief wins at 20-1?
No, definitely not. In fact, I remember that Breeders' Cup was, you know, it was the first time the Filly and Mare Turf was run, and it was actually the closest Christophe Clément has come to winning a race. He lost, of course, to the Jimmy Toner horse, whose name I can't remember right now, Soaring Softly. And then, you know, there were some other really, I was a big Jorge Chavez fan, so I was pleased with Artax and Beautiful Pleasure. And the day seemed like it was making so much sense, right? You had one good horse after another winning. Anise was the only upset. And then that was by far and away, I think in a way, probably Volpone. Arcang obviously is the gold standard, but Volpone was a somewhat shocking Breeders' Cup winner. But Cat Thief, given the way he had run in a couple of races leading into that Breeders' Cup, was as improbable a winner as I think you might ever find.
I agree. And for those that, if you want to see a chart that was just astounding, Cat Thief wins by a length and a quarter at 19.60-1. Bud Royal was second for Ted West at 26.50-1. Golden Missile was third at 75-1. And Chester House was fourth at 63-1 after a bad start, too, and came flying. And the Dollar Super, it's listed as $692,000. The $2 try was $39,000.
Yeah, it was. Let me tell you, if anybody out there hit it, my hat's off to him. That was absolutely insane. I mean, and you know, the expectation, of course, was that either Lemon Drop Kid or Barons were going to run well. River Keen, I think, was pretty fancied after winning the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and they were just all no-shows. Chester House was first time dirt, first time in America.
Yes,
and of course, he ended up going on to win the Arlington Million the next year. And you know, it turned out to be a perfectly fine turf horse. There was no expectation that he was going to be able to run on the dirt. So, yeah, that was a crazy, crazy, crazy result. And I do think that, you know, a big part of it was the inside on that track that day was very, very good.
Yes.
And that certainly helped Cat Thief along. Didn't necessarily help anybody who finished underneath him, but it definitely carried Cash Run, Beautiful Pleasure, Artax to an extent. But boy, what would we give to have that old Gulfstream Oval and Grandstand back?
Yeah, in the backyard.
Totally different topic.
Yeah. Well, 99. That Breeders' Cup also marks memorable for my going down my first live experience as part of Carolina Barbecue came at that Breeders' Cup. So. That was
well. It's good that we're talking. We should. It's good that you brought up 1999 because yesterday was the 21st anniversary of the pilot episode of The Sopranos.
How about
January
that?
1999.
You never know. You never know what wackiness is going to invade the conversation. Good job. I love it.
Absolutely.
Nick, I wanted you. I reached out because the three multi-race sequences that had force outs Friday and Saturday, Friday night Turfway, we talked about actually with Ed, and they had the pick five races, one through five, and that was a $4,700 result with a sixth choice, a favorite, a seventh choice, a favorite, and a second choice, 1760, 440, 4040, Perry Utes, just boots home prices, then 460 and 940. And so if you were able to find you know, the two tricky horses to find in that sequence. But it was really Saturday, and I did back-to-back in the afternoon, the Gulfstream sequence, and then the Sam Houston, the last of the Jackpot Space City six, and two very good starting nights for Sam Houston, $2.5 million both Friday and Saturday. Let's touch on these sequences, Nick. I don't know where, if you want to do Sam Houston or the Gulfstream action, but you know, Gulfstream paid $14,600, had over $5 million bet into it, and this was very reachable. It was a little bit of a ticket building exercise, but this was eminently hittable. Third choice, second choice, fifth choice, third choice, favorite, and second choice, and it paid 14.6.
Yeah, you know, and I think that one of the keys to it is that you can't alter your approach from the way you would normally approach a different type of wager. Or, you know, if you're an old $2 pick six player, how differently should you approach putting together a play in a 20-cent pool on a force out day? And I think that the key to it, of course, I mean, at the end of every exercise in betting, you're going to be dealing with making sure that you assign the right weight and options to the horses that you like. Obviously, you need to make the right A's, you need to make the right B's, you need to make the right C's. If that's what you do, if you're a caveman ticket player, you do want to find whomever in the sequence you really want to back up in terms of, accentuate in terms of who you might want to play again. I know people who like to play multiple caveman tickets where they might have a single in a certain leg and they build around that and maybe build a couple of tickets with that runner singled and different horses at different levels and races around it. So, you know, I think that the sixth leg of it, of course, if you're regularly, I mean, I'm regularly a pick five player, the sixth leg of it often can add a little bit of I wouldn't want to say chaos. It obviously depends on the sequence, but it forces you to be as precise as possible with assigning who you like to how you're going to use them. And you don't want to find yourself simply saying, oh, well, you know, it's a 20-cent bet, so I can use as many as I'd like. And, you know, that sequence at Gulfstream on Saturday started with a 4-to-1 shot that was, I think, the third choice in ordinal betting. And, you know, you're talking about a horse ridden by Irad Ortiz for a high percentage barn sprinting on the turf. So, I mean, it's a very, very obvious horse coming down from Belmont, Henny Penny, who had competed well in New York in the past and was taking a big class drop. And then you had a somewhat similar horse in the second leg with Simovich, who was the second choice, made a lot of sense. I mean, these are horses that really were going to be pretty much on everybody's ticket. And then you get to a horse like Citrus Burst, who's 10-to-1, and this is one where you probably needed to be a little bit more aggressive in order to find that horse. But, you know, if you had used, and the other problem, I think, too, was there was a 3-to-2 favorite that looked like she made a lot of sense. So that was the concern. Because really what these boil down to is how much are you taking the favorite, how much are you taking other options, how deep are you going. And the first four legs of this sequence lacked a favorite, and you had two of them beaten at under 2-to-1. Then you got to the tropical turf where the favorite ended up winning, but you know the three choices were basically all bet to about the same level, and they went off between 2 and 3-to-1. So you didn't really get a break anywhere where you could say, okay, there's a horse that I really want to sink my teeth into and use quite a bit. And so, you know, with the 7-to-2 winner in the nightcap, you ended up getting the 14,000 that you said. And really, I mean, we're talking about a sequence that had one horse that was maybe a little bit of an outside the box type. And we're talking about a 10-to-1 shot, not a 30-to-1 shot or anything like that. So it really, looking at both of them together, looking at Sam Houston next, the Gulfstream one was, it was a lot of sensible and logical horses that you could easily have had. You could easily have used every one of them if you're kind of an ABC ticket structure believer, but not had them on the right, the same ticket. Because that's where you have to balance out the backups with the main.
Well, exactly. And that's what got tricky. It's funny, the horse for me that there was actually two different places where we're using this for me was the pick five. The pick six, I simply didn't spend enough. I had all the horses identified. That wasn't the issue. In the six races, three of the winners were on my pecking order were fourth choices. And there are circumstances where you might be able to, you know, craft a play that, you know, that has that many fourth choices on the same ticket. But, you know, it's like a billiard shot. Citrus Burst, it was a horse that I really, especially at the morning line price, I thought, you know, here's a horse that, you know, that has got the ability to win here. And I made him a C. And that decision ends up costing the pick five. And the pick five paid $4,000. And I hit the pick four, Nick, for $700, and I'm glad, and it made the day worthwhile. But I mean, $4,200 for that pick five, and to have everybody easily identified, and I really was kicking myself, and that includes a backup ticket where at one point I had Ride a Comet as my second choice behind Casa Creed, and I shunted him back, in the pecking order, and that. You know, either him or Citrus Burst needed to be an A and instead of a C, one or the other. And in fact, if they're both, you know, if I somehow get them both right in terms of preference, hit the thing twice, you know, suddenly it's 8,000. I mean, these are. You can assuage yourself by saying, well, I hit, you know, you got 600 and change and you paid for the day. But no, that doesn't, not when you leave 4,200 on the table when you absolutely, you know, had all the I's dotted and the T's crossed and you just didn't follow through.
Yeah, I think the best thing that I could say to describe that was I remember sitting with Tommy Massis at a contest at Gulfstream, and I had hit a trifecta, and I said, boy, if the fourth horse had gotten third, this thing would have paid so much more, but I guess I can't complain because at least I hit. And he said, nonsense, I'm a pig, I want it all. don't ever be comfortable with what you cash for. You got to figure out how you can get it all. And he's exactly right. I mean, and he said to me, that's a loser's mentality. So, I mean, that's of course, Tommy exaggerating a tad, but, you know, we all know why he's good at that period. And it is because we want to figure out how to get all of it. I mean, it's nice to hit a pick four and make a profit, and, you know, but we all want to find a way to hone our skills and fine tune the way we're putting our tickets together so that we can hit something bigger. You know, why hit a pick four when you can hit a pick five? And, you know, one of the things that's made me a slightly better pick five player, I'm not a particularly good pick six player. I just have no background with it at all. And I think these force outs tend to be bad examples. They're a really dangerous way of trying to make yourself a better pick six player because you're swimming with sharks and you're also generally dealing with big fields, competitive races, things like that. So structuring tickets and pick sixes can be very, very difficult. But, I think one of the things that makes you a better pick five player is when you write your numbers down and you take a look at what you want to do with the sequence, you have to look back and make sure that you're doing the right thing in terms of approaching what could become chaotic. You know, do you have something clever on your ticket? If you don't and you feel confident in it, then you need to bet your ticket for more. Right? I mean, if you're generally a 50 cent or $1 player and you feel like there might be an opportunity for you to go, you know, 2x1x2x3x1, and you're talking about $12, you may want to put that in for $2 or $3 more.
Well,
spend a little bit extra money.
Well, and riff on that for a second, Nick, and maybe if you want to, I don't know if you want. Well, we'll save the Sam Houston for next. Differentiate between spending more. And I appreciate, you know, how you couched the pick six portion of the discussion. But, you know, I came away feeling like, you know, instead of spending 60, I probably needed to spend, you know, 120 to 150 if I was going to seriously attack that, you know, the Gulfstream pick six. And, you know, that has never been my preferred approach. And I really, at the same time, can't hold myself back from, you know, putting in the, you know, the modest budget ticket, thinking, and Seth Merrow and I have discussed this a million times, you know, Seth's got the, you know, small ticket idea that when I'm right, it's going to pay for any time I've missed. I'm in the camp that says, you know, I want to take a swing at this, but I'm just not going to spend hundreds. And, you know, I see plenty of people that take the approach where they're spending hundreds, even on pick fours and pick fives in some cases. And there are occasions where that pays off, and people are getting five digit scores, you know, 10,000 and above, and you know, mid five figure hits, spending, you know, 200, 350, 500 and 600. I can't, even if I had unlimited budget, I don't think I would do that. And I just, at the same time, you get frustrated thinking to yourself, you know, you wouldn't have hurt to throw another $60, $80 at this, and you would have really given yourself at least the best chance to hit.
Yeah, and a lot of that is going to come down to trial and error. You know, there are going to be sequences where you bet and you think to yourself, boy, if I had bet a little bit more, I would have hit for more. It's not always that simple, right? I mean, it's not, you know, I know the there was a tremendous amount of fondness in the Jockey Club at Sam Houston for one of the guys in there who bet a pick six every day in New York, and he spent between $2 and $8. And so somebody said one day, boy, if we just each gave Joe $20 and let him put it into the pick six, then he'd probably win left and right. And I said, you sure about that? Because now he's going to become a lazier handicapper. And he's going to say, well, I got more money to spend, so I'm just going to use more horses. And he's probably going to win at about the same rate, but obviously he's going to make a smaller profit. And so that's the concern, is that are you spending more money because you simply want more coverage? Because if you're doing that, then if you're a mid-range budget type of player, you probably should be sitting out, right? You should be looking for sequences that fit your budget if it's something where you feel like you're somewhat limited by your capital. If you have money, if you have a sequence that you particularly like, then that needs to become a situation where you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to really go after this one. I might sit out three or four in this pool over the next couple of days if I'm a, you know, fairly, I guess, aggressive recreational player, oxymoron that that is. But, you know, that might be your approach, because what you're trying to do is make a profit on that one where you have a good opinion. So, you know, take Santa Anita opening day, for example. If you felt strongly about a horse like Charlatan, and maybe you felt like there was an avenue for duopoly, and those were two horses that you liked, well, then obviously you want to structure as many multi-race bets as possible, accentuating those two, using them prominently, and trying to cash. And you could have done very, very well if you would have found your way into Fair Maiden and the Nightcap winner. So you have to let the sequence dictate it. You can't, I don't think you can say to yourself, I have $100 to play the pick five, let me look at the pick five. I don't think that's a wise approach. And I think in the long run, you're going to end up hurting yourself. I think that Seth's approach that you alluded to, you know, Paul Matisse talks a lot about this, bet a little to make a lot, and understand that you're going to lose the overwhelming majority of the time. As long as you have the right psyche and the right amount of confidence in your process, that's fine. Because, I mean, let's not kid ourselves, we're all going to go through prolonged losing streaks. We're going to go through time where we're handicapping well and we're getting no luck on the racetrack. We're going to go through times where we're not handicapping well at all, we're not betting well, et cetera, et cetera. But if you can pick up the Sunday racing form after you went through Saturday and you may have played one or two tracks and not hit a bet, then go with it. Keep going with that. If you're somebody that kind of needs to see things go the right way once, and you'll start to bet with more confidence, then you want to be careful about taking that approach of maybe only spending $16 or $32 on a sequence and waiting to cash for big type of money. The problem that I've always seen with people that take that kind of approach is that you just don't want to waste good priced horses. And you don't want to, you know, if you were somebody that liked Citrus Burst on Saturday and you didn't hit the pick six, I really hope you bet him to win. Right, because you need that $23 and change in order to kind of keep yourself afloat. You know, you and I were texting on opening day at Santa Anita and kind of lamenting that I keyed Fair Maiden with two horses that finished off the board. And so I didn't feel terrible because I didn't really love Fair Maiden. Now, I definitely should have bet her to win. If she was a horse that, if I had keyed her and not bet her to win and somehow missed the try, I mean, I would have been very, very upset, because you can't miss those opportunities. So I think that's the best approach to take. And if you're somebody that's really jumping into these pick sixes, to get back to the origin of the conversation, on force out days, then you don't want to let your bankroll limit you. You want to go through the sequence, get a sense of what it looks like. And, you know, it might be one of those days. There was a force out day, I think, on New Year's Eve 2019 into 2020 at Aqueduct, where it looked like it was going to be exceptionally chalky. And the favorites won three out of the first four legs. The second choice won the fifth leg. And then like a 9-1 first-time starter won the last. I think it paid a couple thousand. And it was a great opportunity for somebody that could have put, you know, $64 into it to make a couple of grand. So look at it, see if it's that kind of sequence, see if that might be an opportunity for you to, you know, to get after it. And, I mean, let me tell you, a great opportunity for that right now, and I am a completely unpaid spokesperson. I'm somebody that wants to be an advocate for horse players. Start betting the Aqueduct Pick 6. Bet this Aqueduct Pick 6 with a 20% takeout and a mandatory daily pay, because it's going to be a great, and let's not kid ourselves, I mean, the racing's been much better this current meet than it's been in past years, but you're not going to be dealing with 12 horse fields one after another. You're also going to get great information on the telecast about track biases and things like that. But it's going to be a good opportunity for you to start to get a little bit more involved in structuring tickets and seeing how you want to play sequences. And then, of course, you have a pick 5 and a pick 4 to back you up if you somehow get knocked out of the pick 6. It's from a low price point. It has a low takeout, so to speak, for a pick 6. So that's a good opportunity. And these are the kind of bets that we need to be putting our money into to show track management and, you know, the industry in general that, yeah, there is, you know, there may not be a ton of it, but there is some price sensitivity and there is some attention paid to the kind of pools that really benefit us most being involved.
No, and I'm glad you brought the Aqueduct portion in, because you had a little mini thread where, you know, you had a back-to-back post about it yesterday, and I got distracted and I meant to recirculate it. So I'm glad you included that in the conversation, because, you know, obviously Tony Alivato and the team are going to evaluate, you know, the approach going forward based on, you know, how they do with it here these next 3 weeks, and the early returns are positive. And I maintain, with Sam Houston starting Thursday, going to a standard pick 6, no more jackpot starting Thursday, and a very aggressive pricing, there's every reason to sense that there's a pendulum swing going away from the jackpot concept. I'm sure that Stronach Group Tracks will continue with it, because they, you know, they crafted it and have had big success with it. And that's understandable that they'll maintain it. But you know, those that you know, kind of got in, I'm anxious to see what Churchill's thoughts are in the spring, because Churchill actually hasn't gotten enough credit for, they have one, but their pricing structure is very different than everybody else's. And they, it's not as usury. It's not structured as oppressively as most of the others. But I think the pendulum is coming back in the other direction. Let's talk about that Sam Houston portion. And, you know, these first two nights of racing, Nick, came off very well. The force out on Saturday, people right away, I'm sure, were feeling, you know, like they took a Coke bottle to the head with the longest shot on the board. He could go all the way. I know that Jessica Paquette made a case for this one, going long on the turf, that he had something that you could use as a foundation for backing him. I went back and I just didn't really see it. The horse in the Nightcap that paid 31, I could much more easily make a case for Heavenly Rhythm at the end. But talk about what we saw at Sam Houston on Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically that. It was a couple of price horses bookending what was otherwise a pretty formful sequence. And, I mean, he could go all the way, who was 30-1 on the morning line. I mean, I thought he was kind of an underlay. He seemed very, very hard to find. And I think it's not so much because you couldn't find some things to like about that particular horse. But, you know, it felt like the majority of the time that that race was run, it was going to be won by the one or the six. And then they sort of inexplicably get involved in a pace duel. And the one obviously has stamina issues, which we talked about a little bit on Friday. And so he, you know, he capitulated readily at the 3/16 pole, and the six was done as well from being on the chase. And, you know, one thing about the Sam Houston turf, especially early in the meet, is that, I mean, even though the weather is very moderate here, it's still, of course, it has a little bit more moisture than it would later in the meet. So it's a little difficult to quicken, and you're going to see the times get slow. It actually snowed in Houston yesterday, for what it's worth. It sleeted a little bit on my car as I drove to pick up a Vietnamese soup, but not anything significant. So there was supposedly like 8 inches in North Texas, which for us is a full-out panic. But anyway, so, you know, he could go all the way, got a great trip, saved ground, tipped out, got the job done, beat Flexati, who seemed like a pretty, you know, pretty obvious use. Then after that, you had, you know, one sort of formful result after another. Ultimate won the sixth race and was expected to do so, got up right on the wire over Bobby Brinkley. They were the 1-2 first and second choices. And then the J.R. Caldwell winner of the eighth was probably the only maybe slight surprise at 4-1 or so. Other than that, you had Bear Bryant got up right on the wire in the seventh as the second choice behind Vegas Guy. And then the ninth race winner, who is trained by Scott Young, Bourbon Wisdom, ran very well. And was another, you know, horse that you were supposed to use even if you were only two deep. And then that got you the nightcap, where the two favorites were very questionable. And it ended up that the 2, 3, and 4 went off the choices. And half of the entry felt like, either half of the entry felt like they could be competitive. One of the things that went on was that the plain one got a very, very good ride. I still have some work to do. It felt to me as the night wore on like the rail was bad. There were a few horses that spent a significant amount of time on the inside and ended up tiring. One of them was Vegas Guy. One of them was Onomatopoeia, who I liked in the ninth and just had no punch whatsoever trying to come through on the inside. And basically every winner was kind of an outside rallier as the night wore on. So that's something I'll take a look at, and obviously we'll let everybody know what my conclusions are. But so this was a sequence where, you know, and this is anecdotal on my part. I've not studied it. I've not really even asked anybody who looks at this kind of information. The biggest price that you had was in the first leg. I've always believed that it's less significant to have a big price in the first leg in terms of payoff than any other leg, because so many people want to get out of that first leg and simply be alive. And so I think there are more opportunities for people to go deeper than there really are anywhere else. So, you know, you look at the Breeders' Cup this year, right? I know 5 different people who had to pick 4 because they used all in the mile. It was the first leg, you know, and maybe that's simply just, as I said, maybe that's anecdotal. Maybe that's something that isn't concrete, but still, I don't think he could go all the way. Being in the third or fourth leg would have actually made him an even less likely horse to be on tickets than with him being in the first leg. So this was a sequence where you needed to obviously take what looked like a relatively competitive race on paper, go as deep as you could. The issue for somebody like me would have been he could go all the way at all. But if you had used him as a backup, you needed to be right in 5 consecutive legs. Or if you liked him maybe good enough to be a B, then you needed to have 4 A's win in a row, which I think was reasonable for most people, and then have the entry in the nightcap as at least a B if you were playing 2 B tickets. So it was a very, very tough result. And look, I mean, you were rewarded handsomely if you were able to connect on it. But it was a fun sequence. And I'm hopeful that there will be a lot of support for a 50-cent pick 6 with a 12% takeout, which is what Sam Houston is going to be doing starting on Thursday when racing resumes. And, yeah, I mean, I think there's – and actually Sam Houston, like Churchill, as you were saying, the price point on the structure of the jackpot bet, it has 12% takeout and 13% went to the carryover. So it basically was a 23.5-24% effective takeout. And of course, what that means is that the carryover grows slowly, right? And the places that are doing these jackpot bets that are really handling big money, their effective takeout is in the neighborhood of 60-70%. And even Gulfstream is close to 50. That's why the carryover pool grows so much. And so my hope with Naira, I actually just learned this morning that they did not pay out the pick 6 in the month of January in 2020. So the comparison year to year is going to be apples to apples. Now, as the carryover pot grew, the handle also grew, but it kind of tapered off later in January. So the comparison is going to be fair. It did not pay out until the second week of February in 2020. It also handled $2.5 million that day. So that's the thing to remember, is that these jackpot bets are always going to have a huge pool when they're paid out. You know, the thing to remember about that is that that pool is going to be made up of money that is not the money that made the carryover grow. And that's difficult for the regular player, whether they're somewhat serious or even recreational.
Overall, Nick, a quick thoughts about the two nights, Friday as well?
I mean, the support from the wagering public was outstanding. I mean, it's good to see $100,000 pick four and pick five pools at Sam Houston. And I know that that Frank and his staff, Chris, did a great job with marketing and getting the word out. And $2.5 million on opening night at Sam Houston, I'd have to ask Frank, but I want to say I think that's the most they've had this century. So going all the way back to, you know, meet used to open in November. But that's a really, really strong number, really good racing the first couple of nights. And the next three cards all look good. The racing resume on Thursday. So, yeah, I mean, it's all leading towards that January 31st date with the Houston Ladies Classic and the John Connolly on the same program. I think things are looking like they're going to be very, very strong at Sam Houston. And Sam Houston was in the middle of a tremendous meet in 2020 before the pandemic derailed it. And I think it would have kind of been the early season standard for handle increases. Handle was up, I want to say, about 30%, similar to what it was up. In fact, it was up even more through the first couple of nights. But, yeah, I think it's going to continue that direction, and I encourage people looking for a nighttime signal to take a good hard look at it. There's not a whole lot going on that time of night, especially later on once Turfway ends, and you'll get good opportunities. Thursdays are going to be very interesting, I would think, because they're going to sort of be the first of the night tracks with the 4 o'clock local start, and that's going to get them a little bit in front of Turfway. And I think what Frank was looking for was to try and fit into the niche that Santa Anita would have had if they were racing on Thursdays. So hopefully we'll get some Southern California support as well. So it should continue to be a very fun meet.
Well, and we'll feature analysis, much like we did with Indiana. We'll attack that the Thursday slot as well each week through the meet at Sam Houston, SHRP, Sam Houston Race Park. And Nick, I appreciate the Monday visit, and we'll talk later in the week. Of course, I've already mentioned that we've got a big fairgrounds. I don't know if you've looked ahead to Saturday at fairgrounds, but that's crazy. It's going to be a very good day of racing, and the weather is going to cooperate. So it feels like we're really this was the weekend that kind of gets the wheels in motion and starting to pull out of the station for 2021.
Full steam ahead.
Exactly. NTAMM1215. Nick Tamaro, everybody. We'll talk to Nick later in the week. Right now, we got about 15 minutes to close out the morning, and we'll get to Phil D'Amato tomorrow. And, of course, Andy Serling will join us as well, but didn't get to Phil today. I feel bad, so I'll get him tomorrow. And obviously, we'll have day one of the sale, which is now 45 minutes into the four-day run. Brian Sanfratello is joining us from the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders. And, Brian, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Steve.
It's
like
good
you
to
said, we're off and running.
Right? You got to be girded for everything, you got to be prepared, certainly with the start of the foaling season. And I talked about this with Sid Fernando on Wednesday. The babies are starting to drop. We're starting to see first foals from first-year stallions. And it's also stallion auction season. And that includes the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. You guys have been doing this for over 10 years.
Yep. We start this evening, midnight, actually midnight tomorrow morning on our 11th stallion season auction. Right now we have approximately 75, 80 stallions, but we are adding more as we speak.
Really?
We're adding in and all Always Dreaming from Windstar.
Wow.
We're going to be adding something shortly from Spendthrift. Just waiting for Mark Toothaker to get back to me on that, and should prove to be another good season. You can view all the stallions right now online at pabred.com under our stallion season auction. But if you want to bid on them, you want to go to thoroughlybred.com. That's the online auction site, and sign up for a free registration so you'll be ready to go. The auction is going to last approximately a week. It'll start midnight tonight and end on the 18th at 9 p.m. And pretty easy to register for it. We have stallions from five different states. Nice contingent from Pennsylvania. And you definitely want to take a look at those Pennsylvania horses because of the fact that the breeder awards are so lucrative if you race that horse in Pennsylvania. You're talking 50% breeder award for maiden races, first through third, and 40% for all others. If you don't breed to a PA stallion, you still have 25% breeder awards for maiden races and 20% for all others. So it's a great program, and it's a great way to start off by getting a good deal on a season.
Well, and, one thing that from year to year people may forget, just because it's the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association, it's not, as Brian just referenced, it's not just Pennsylvania stallions. You've got New York represented in here and Maryland, Kentucky. There's lots to choose from. And, for those that might have missed out on the TCA, you might have gone there. Might be any number actually of crossovers that you made a play for on Friday at the TCA auction, and you didn't get priced out, and come back and take a look here, because there's not just the single season. There's a few of the stallions that have got multiple seasons, and we should feature that. Sky Kingdom at Darby Dan, you got the chances at three seasons. Smarty, there's two Smarty Jones seasons, so it's not limited to one. Uptown Charlie Brown, who's been really a story that needs more attention from limited opportunity. He's thrown nothing but runners. Warriors Reward has got a pair as well at Win Oak. So this is a list that really should be reviewed. There's names on here that are really going to surprise you. Some first year stallions at all these different venues.
Yep, definitely. Definitely take a look at the auction. Like I said, if you're ready to roll in 2021, there's no better way than get a good deal on the sale. Also, I'd just like to bring up the fact that if you're buying a mare in foal right now at the Keeneland sale, you have 14 days to bring that mare into Pennsylvania, drop that mare in PA, and be eligible for the PA program. So another good way to get involved in it.
Boy, that's a timely. How about that? I did not know that because usually mare residency is typically much longer, right? It's usually a 90-day period or so. So that's a fascinating little sidebar.
Yep. Usually you have to be, the mayor has to be in the state by December 1st.
Yeah.
But if you bring her in within 14 days of sale after December 1st and she foals in Pennsylvania,
wow,
she'll be eligible for the program.
You should also note that, you know, in some cases, a lot of cases with the stallion seasons, they're non-guarantee. But as it happens, you've got quite a few on this roster that you know, is a live foal condition as opposed to a non-guarantee season.
Yep. We try to get as many as, you know, as we can that are live foals. You know, some of the stallions on there, you know, the higher priced stallions, we usually don't get a live foal on.
Well, the Candy Rides, you know, Candy Ride on this list, and you know, that of that ilk, you know, you understand. But you know, seemingly all the Pennsylvania stallions are live foal. We talked to Mark Cassie earlier today. Air Force is on this list. Is it Equistar Training and Breeding? It's kind of skimming down. Command Post at Win Oaks, live foal. Courageous Cat at Quest Royal. And I've got a nice Courageous Cat. We've got Minute Mouse. And Crown of Thorns at Equistar. These are both live foal. Going down here. Who else we got?
I just looked at my computer. We just got a Golden Lad also.
Nice. A little Golden Lad action. Nice. Here's Majestic City at Irish Hill and Duchess View. And this really is a nice list going up and down. Lane's End was very generous with you, too. Liam's Map, Mineshaft. There's quite a bit. Mr. Speaker, Darby Dan, and Lane's End, both with a hat full of their stallions.
Yep, absolutely. Lane's End and some of the other ones have been really great to us over the years as far as the seasons are concerned. So, you know, we developed, you know, a relationship with a lot of the Kentucky farms, and it works for both of us.
Well, and as you mentioned, we'll watch for Always Dreaming to be added, and You just added Golden Lad. Klimp down here for Darby Dan. Honor Code, Honor AP. Gift Box, Lane's End is mentioned. Wow, really nice. This is Midshipman. There's a lot to consider in here, and starting tomorrow at midnight, or actually tonight at midnight, and going through Monday. So we'll remind people going into the weekend, and then, of course, next Monday as well.
Yeah, but I'd just like to remind everyone that, you know, if you're getting a non-guaranteed season, you can, you know, purchase insurance on that to cover, you know, for those higher-priced stallions.
Nice. Brian, we got about 2-3 minutes. Give us a little update. We haven't spoken since the fall, and you know, the program and the opportunities, obviously coming out of the COVID affected year that really, you know, touched everybody from Erie to Ben Salem. Talk about looking back at the year and surviving essentially.
Yeah, I mean, the Stallion Farms did a fantastic job during COVID, you know, making sure that you know, everyone was safe as they brought the, you know, as they took the mares in for breeding. And, you know, quite frankly, I wasn't sure at first how the season was going to go, but it actually went quite well. You know, one of the things that we also talked about was the governor's proposal to take money from the Racehorse Development Trust Fund, which did not happen. As you know, we put that fund in a trust in 2017, and, you know, the backing behind not touching that fund really was fantastic by the legislature. So I wanted people to understand that, you know, because the first thing they think about is, oh, will the money be there? Because we're looking to you know, 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road before you're raising that work. And, Knock on wood, everything went well. Money was not touched during that period, and hopefully people will understand that we're going to do what we can to make sure that that money goes where it's supposed to breeding and racing in Pennsylvania.
Well, and when we talked about it, and when we had Tommy Thompson on, the concern, just the headlines, was enough to make people worry. And in terms of Mayor's Bread, when does that report? When do we hear those numbers?
Well, the Mayor's Bread report came out, and we were up. We're up again. I think it was approximately 5%. So again, for fourth straight year, we've been up since 17, approximately 50 some percent up in Pennsylvania, when the rest of the country is approximately 15% down. So again, I can thank those breeders for hanging in there and bringing their mares and breeding to in Pennsylvania. So again, like I said, when I first looked at 2020, I said to myself, well, I don't know how this is going to work out with everything that's going on, but the breeders and the stallion farms did a fantastic job.
Well, we'll start to hear about babies, and we'll watch for fuzzy foals to start dropping, and we'll certainly keep everybody alerted to this terrific list. Start at pabred.com, and the auction is featured right in the center. You'll see the whole the whole list of stallions, but the sale itself is at thoroughlybred.com, and this is a nice list, and there might be a very nice opportunity to match up exactly the stallion that you want for your mare. And we'll keep everybody checking in on it. Lots of time, too. You got literally a week from tonight through till next Monday evening. Brian, continued success, and we'll check in as the season unfolds.
Thanks, Steve. It's great talking to you again, as usual.
My pleasure. Brian Sanfratello, everybody, the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association, pabred.com. And you can follow Brian at Breiter Farm, B-R-I-T-E-R Farm, on Twitter as well. There you go. I think we had this conversation maybe last year, but I had forgotten that there were so many other, other stallions from the region and from Kentucky included. So take a look. Calumet with a bunch as well. A lot of first crop, first time stallions that represented. Gonna have to look it over. And we haven't made decisions ourselves. We have to wait. We want to see the baby that Voltarine delivers in March. That was a fast Monday. Monday's always a blur. Thanks to Mig and to Mark Cassie and Nick Tamaro and Brian Sanfratello, KC on the board. Good luck if you're playing today. Limited choices of racing today, but it's okay. Back with you tomorrow, 9 o'clock. If you missed anything, replay 6 to 9 or steebeck.com. Little archive and pod. We'll talk to you in the morning. Thanks, everybody.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred